Hello and welcome to this episode of the Global Innovators in Business series. In this series, we bring leaders and innovators from different fields to share their advice and experiences with undergraduate students to provide inspiration and motivation during the pandemic. We are so happy to have with us Fred Mosler. Fred was a part of the original founding team of Zappos and alongside Tony Hsieh and others helped Zappos grow into a company with more than $1 billion in gross merchandise sales before it was bought by Amazon in 2009. He is also the founder of Las Vegas-centric investment fund Holness Capital and the co-founder of luxury fashion brand Ross & Snow. This whole interview is dedicated to the Goody Two Shoes Foundation. The Goody Two Shoes Foundation provides disadvantaged children and children in crisis with new shoes and socks, as well as other items deemed essential for good health and positive development. Thank you so much for being here, Fred.
Oh, thanks for having me, Christopher. I appreciate it. And I just learned that you're a local Las Vegan as well. So that's really cool to have this opportunity. Thank you.
Yeah. I mentioned to you before, but Zappos and your team was a huge inspiration for people in my high school, for me when I was younger, because you know that a company that was so innovative and so transcending was just 10 minutes down the road across the street was something that was always something that we could look forward to. So why did you choose to dedicate this interview to the Goody Two Shoes Foundation?
Well, I have to tell you, I met Tony and Nikki Birdie and I fell in love with them. Tony played for the NFL Chargers for 4 years. And after he left pro football, they moved to Las Vegas and wanted to find a way to give back to the community. And so they started the Goody Two Shoes Foundation back in Great. And as mentioned, it focuses on disadvantaged children, children at crisis, and providing them with a new pair of shoes that are properly fit. But what really touches me about what they do is it's not just about getting the new shoes, it's about providing choice. So they have a 48-foot mobile shoe store that they drive to the high schools or the elementary schools. And for every pair of shoes that they give away, the children have a choice of at least 4 shoes. So they teach the children that they have a choice, and the whole process just builds confidence in the children and self-esteem, because for many of these children, it's the first time that they've got to pick out a new pair of shoes, and they had a choice. And so, gosh, I think by now they've given away over 100,000 pairs of shoes and touched a lot of lives. So that's why I wanted to dedicate this interview to them.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Zappos and the Goody Two Shoes Foundation, a huge part of your life has been around shoes. Why shoes?
You know, shoes, it was a little bit, I don't know, serendipitous. I loved shoes when I was a child. I loved business and I loved shoes for some reason. And I was a little bit of a geek when I was 6 years old. While my friends were reading comic books, I was reading the business section of the paper. And I didn't even really understand what business was, but I was always intrigued by it. And I always was intrigued by the latest fashion in footwear. And I think the Nike El Cortez or the Adidas Top 10, you know, when I was growing up in the 80s, those were the rage. And, you know, I always wanted the freshest, newest pair of kicks. And, you know, so I would save my money from my paper route to make sure that I was styled right. And in college, I went to a small liberal arts college in Southern Oregon. And, you know, in the summertime there, the job opportunities weren't great in the community. And so I ended up making money by working at a local shoe store there for the summers and kind of got connected to footwear that way. And after school, I ended up moving to Seattle, and I was fortunate enough to get a role with Nordstrom and in the footwear department. And I worked my way up through the ranks at Nordstrom and found myself in San Francisco in the latter half of the 90s. At San Francisco Center buying footwear. And that's kind of where I, you know, the internet was exploding around me. It was a new form of commerce. There was so much energy and excitement about this new revolution. I used to think, gosh, how do I get involved in this? I was lucky enough to just get a phone call one day from a gentleman who had this idea of selling footwear online and creating the first online shoe store. He had met a gentleman and pitched the idea, and an investor at the time turned out to be Tony Hsieh, about this idea of selling shoes on the internet, which, you know, today seems like it makes a lot of sense. Back then it seemed a little crazy, but Tony saw the vision, and he told Nick Swinmurn, the founder of Zappos, that you need somebody from the footwear industry, and call Nordstrom or Macy's, and just happened to call me, and the three of us met, discussed it, and Tony invested, and I left Nordstrom and joined, and two-bedroom apartment, San Francisco, and we got started from there.
That part is so interesting, because at this time, Zappos wasn't Zappos. It was Nick Schumer's dropshipping company that was very small. But you had a very stable job. You worked at Nordstrom for 8 years. You've had all this experience. What made you finally make the step, leap forward to go to a startup company?
I guess it was, I could kind of see that this was kind of a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. And I saw the future of this digital revolution. Fortunately, I was ingrained in it. Like I said, it was all around me. And I have an entrepreneurial bug myself. You know, I looked at the name on the door where I was working at Nordstrom, and I knew my name would not be on the door. And this presented me with an opportunity, a whiteboard to try and create something of my own. You know, I think at the time I was kind of moving up the ladder at Nordstrom. I had a good career and they were very good to me. I had an infant and one on the way and a new mortgage and everything. And it was a scary time. But, you know, people used to talk to me about the stability of Nordstrom at the time. And it turns out that risky decision was a safe decision with kind of what retail has now gone through. And so, you know, there came that fateful day. It wasn't an easy decision for me, but Nick said, you know what, I need you to make a leap of faith. And I did. And I'm so happy I did. So very fortunate.
Yeah, that a risky decision sometimes can be the safest decision.
And exactly. That,
where did you see the company going? Did you think that this was the company that you would dedicate the huge part of your life to? Or do you think that this was just your venture into the startup world?
You know, I guess I had hopes. When I started at Zappos, it was called ShoeSite.com. So we hadn't even changed the name to Zappos yet. But, well, I guess when I was talking to them, by the time I started, we had renamed it to Zappos. But, you know, for sure, that was a dream. You know, I pursued a dream and a hope. But I guess I couldn't dream that big in terms of where Zappos ended up. It exceeded any of my wildest imagination. And the journey that we went on exceeded my wildest imagination. So, you know, I think like most entrepreneurs, especially first-time entrepreneurs, you show up a little bit naive, you show up with a lot of passion and determination, and you show up with a big dream, and you go for it, and you hope it ends well. And that's kind of how I got started.
So what was the early days in, I think, ShoeSite or at Dapo? I know Tony Hsieh wasn't that involved in the very beginning, he was just an investor. So what was the dynamics just between you and Nick and I think the small team that he had at that time?
Yeah, we moved out of the two-bedroom apartment into a small office. You know, at the time, we had a minimal amount of funding. So a large part of our time was focused on trying to raise the Series A, the next larger round of funding. And then it was to attract footwear brands to join our site. You couldn't really have customers without a selection. Mm-hmm. And there was a semi-annual footwear show in Las Vegas that we flew to, and all of the footwear brands, wholesale brands, show up to meet with all of the retailers. That time, no one knew that I had left Nordstrom. They all thought I was still at Nordstrom. And so I walked in, and Nordstrom's very prestigious, and I had a large checkbook at Nordstrom, and walked in and started talking to him about this new company I just joined, Zappos, and selling shoes on the internet. Boy, it was a lot of great friends and a lot of great relationships in the industry, but it was really hard to convince anyone. And I think over 4 days, I spoke to 80 brands, and I think only four agreed to work with us. And so I had to really love to embrace rejection. But we, you know, we went back and we worked on getting those four brands up and running, and we did so. But, you know, those early days, everything took so long to get done. It was a very arduous process. And you didn't feel like, you felt like you were kind of walking in cement every day, you know, with how slow things move. But when you're small and you're resource constrained, that's, you know, that's how it starts.
That's so interesting. What was the first reality check that you had for Zappos?
I think the first reality check was when we ran out of funding. We had been talking to a few VC firms in Silicon Valley. And so I started August 1st, I guess, of 99. And our first round of funding from Tony ran out, or was scheduled to run out, mid-December. We had a lot of great conversations with several VCs, but, you know, in the 11th hour, they all kind of fell through. And I remember sitting in our office, and we were in Emeryville across the bay from San Francisco. And there was a Chubby's or something in the parking lot. And, you know, we kind of spent the morning talking about how we gave it a good run. And, but, you know, we're out of money. So we went down. I think we had lunch and maybe a margarita for lunch, and came back up and, you know, kind of started clearing out our desks. And we got a phone call that afternoon from Tony and Alfred Lynn. They had a list of requirements for us. You know, we move out of the office and move into Tony's apartment in San Francisco so we could save that money in office rent. B, Tony and Alfred had some other people they thought could help out the company. So if we accepted this assistance, and then Tony was going to start to jump in and help us out as well. Mm-hmm. And we said, absolutely. We agree to everything. Mm-hmm. And so the end of December 99, we moved into San Francisco and into Tony's apartment, but Alfred had his office there as well, and kind of started the next chapter.
This is Tony's apartment. Well, what was the apartment like, having offices and sleeping quarters?
He, you know, set up all of our desks in his like living room. So we had like 8 desks with, you know, computers on them in the living room. So, and it was fun. It was interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. If we needed to meet with vendors, we would always try to meet with them at a restaurant, because we didn't obviously wanted a perception of being something bigger than we were. So it was funny. I'll never forget one instance. I think we had formed a relationship with a third party retailer to build out our athletics section. They were a physical brick and mortar athletic retailer. And they gave us a product feed that we would just put up on Zappos to fulfill our athletic section. Mm-hmm. And Time, we offered a 10% off or $10 off coupon if you registered for Zappos. We walked in one morning and there were about 5,000 orders on the floor. You know, they were just printing out at the time, paper orders. We thought, what happened? And I guess that night, that retailer put up this like Reebok soccer cleat, children's soccer cleat, for like $9.95. And then somehow that got put on a bulletin board somewhere and went viral. And so people were signing up, registering for Zappos, getting the $10 coupon, buying the soccer cleat, and then getting a nickel back. Mm-hmm. And Alfred Lynn, he was our CFO eventually at Zappos and now partner at Sequoia Capital. I'll never forget, he walked in and he just kind of looked at the big mess of paper, and we're all scrambling around trying to figure things out, and said, this business will never be sustainable. So that was a historical moment for us, but we made it through.
Yeah. Well, what was the fix to that problem?
I think we just had to apologize to a lot of people and probably disappointed a lot of people that day. And we certainly paid a lot closer attention to the product feeds.
Mm. But that's when you're a startup, you have those kind of...
You do. Yeah. Yeah. Those crises. Yeah. Mm. We can laugh about them now, fortunately.
Mm. Yeah. Then what was the darkest time during that period of growth for Zappos?
You know, I think we were still trying to raise funding. Tony and Alfred agreed to give us another 3 months worth of funding to see what kind of progress we made, but we were unsure about the funding beyond that. And I guess that spring of 2000, the dot-com bubble burst, and overnight, capital just dried up. No one was investing in. Everyone had just got really stung by dot-coms. No one was looking to invest money in startups, internet, especially commerce startups at that particular point. So we thought, oh my gosh, we're done. But to the credit of Tony and Alfred and the team, we stayed committed and we continued to make progress. And as we made progress, they continued to fund us in tranches quarterly. You'd get right down to the last day of the quarter and you wouldn't know if you're going to be around tomorrow. They would kind of weigh how much progress we made, and if they felt good about it, which they did, then they would invest another quarter. And we kind of followed that cadence for about a year and a half. So it was exhilarating and stressful. But I think many of our eventual core values, do more with less, be passionate and determined, were born in those early times.
Of course, I read Tony's book, and I just remember at some point you had to choose which debt to pay back. That must be so much pressure. And how did he even decide or like try to figure out that those kind of impossible problems?
Yes, it was always a juggling act. But everyone on the team was so committed. And we started gaining traction fairly quickly. You could see this was going to work. You knew this was going to work. And we all knew we couldn't let this thing fail. We were all in this small rowboat together, everybody rowing as hard as they could to make progress. It was the team. It was the team and the belief and the belief in one another. And also that we didn't want to let each other down. It was a stressful time then. Looking back, it was a very special time.
I know you currently advise like smaller startups during this period of growth and when they begin. What kind of advice do you give them from your experience at Apple?
Don't get discouraged. And Tony had a great phrase. He said, it's never a lack of resources. It's a lack of resourcefulness. There's a solution to every challenge, but it may be harder to find. So you can't give up. If you hit one dead end, you back up and try a different direction. Mm-hmm. And then you just continue to keep at it. You continue to validate ideas and collect data and try to make good decisions with that data.
Davos grew tremendously from that point on. How did the company manage its culture and its people during that period of exponential growth?
You know, again, that was born out of the lack of resources. We, for probably the first 5 years of Zappos, it was really difficult to raise any funding. So we couldn't spend crazy amounts of money to acquire customers. And so when we acquired a customer, that customer was very special to us. And we wanted to make sure to keep that customer and make sure that they came back, purchased more from us in the future. And so, you know, it kind of grew out of the wanting to take care of those customers and understanding how special they were to us that led to the company culture of taking care of the people in the company. And that if we care about our people, then our people will care about our customers. And it just becomes this virtuous cycle. And the better the service, the more autonomy and freedom that we gave the folks in Zappos, all of our people, the happier they made our customers, and the happier the customers were, the more viral Zappos was, the more they talked about us, and the more people our story would reach. At the end of the day, the word of mouth became our best form of marketing. And our culture evolved from having the largest selection of shoes online to being powered by service, having the very best service, to really being about, as we all know Zappos today, about being the very best company culture. And we felt that our culture and our brand were just two sides of the same coin. Eventually, customer actually wasn't the priority. It was the culture. And, you know, an example of that would be company picnics or company all hands or company parties. We would shut down the call center. And for those few hours, the focus was on the culture and the people in the company at the expense of the customer. But at the end of the day, it was an investment in the people, which returned as an investment in the customer experience and that personal emotional connection with the customer.
Yeah, I went to high school in Las Vegas, and I remember the classes that we would take in our business class would be about how Zappos focused on its culture and showing pictures of the office and of collectively chosen pictures of the parties. But it was very shocking for a lot of the students at the time. We never heard of something called holacracy. We never heard of anything that's like having these parties for our customers and having them as a main priority. So that was such a new insight for us high schoolers, and I'm sure even for everybody else who comes to visit.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And because of that, it landed us on the best list of companies to work for, Fortune's list of best companies. And then it just continued to be that virtuous cycle because, you know, we had so many talented people that applied at Zappos and wanted to be a part of that culture. And so we continued to bring in more talented people. And as we built our team, just added to the overall strength and experience of the company.
I know now you're working on your own brand, like Roth and Snow, Nacho Daddy. How have you tried to bring in some of those lessons and that culture and that kind of community energy to your new company?
Yeah, I'm a bit of a serial entrepreneur, but at the end of the day, I like to be involved with companies that put smiles on people's faces, that deliver great experiences, and so we started a company in 2010 called Nacho Daddy here in Las Vegas. And it was based on this concept of taking nachos off the appetizer menu and making them an entree, giving them some respect. So we developed this menu of 20 gourmet nachos with different toppings, kind of like you think about pizza, but really about creating a place that just has a lot of energy and is a place for a variety of people to enjoy. We've got a vegan menu, the kids menu, the families, and so just creating a place that's happy, you know, and there's a lot of energy in and doing something different with food. We started that. It didn't start well. Again, nothing does. At least nothing has been easy for me. I think the first night we opened, the line was 2 hours long. The food came out cold. The service was bad. It was a really terrible experience. I got up the next morning and I read a Yelp I shouldn't have. And a Yelp said, "I wish Nacho Daddy was a food truck, because if it was, I would steal it and I would drive it into Lake Mead. And when it sank to the bottom, even the carp wouldn't eat the food." Oh. That was our first opening night. And fortunately, again, just through a lot of effort and hard work and a dedicated team and really amazing people, we've now grown to 6 restaurants. We're in 2 other states, Salt Lake City and in Georgia. We've got 4 here. We're planning a 5th in Henderson this fall, and we'll be expanding beyond that. And we have 400 employees now, and it's just a great place. And, you know, still a long way to go. Can't take your eye off the ball, but, you know, very proud of what we've done so far. So the Ross and Snow, that was a passion for footwear. Obviously spent my life in footwear. Wanted to stay connected to the footwear industry, had a lot of great relationships in the footwear industry, and wanted to try to do something special. And thought if my wife and I, who my wife Megan is the co-founder, if we built something we loved, we hope others would love it too. And we wanted a brand that kind of share the values and the qualities that we share for craftsmanship, for sustainability, for how the artisans that are making the shoes, how they are treated. So we got that started about 4 years ago. It's really, there's no such thing, in my opinion, as an easy business. If there is, please show me. But marrying a physical product to a digital environment, it's difficult. So we're just kind of starting this journey now, and very small, but we'll continue to plod forward and figure things out.
It's already very, very sizable, and it's doing very well. both of the companies that you talked about and so many other things that we also can mention later on. But I think it's so interesting on the footwear, from Goody Two Shoes to Ross and Snow to Zappos. I think there's always this idea of Nike and Adidas and these companies have these commercials that use footwear as this empowerment tool for people to bring people's confidence, self-esteem. And I think something about shoes creates that. And you've always been in this industry. So what have you found about shoes that changes the person?
Shoes are, I've found a way to express yourself. They're a vehicle that allows kind of your true inner self to shine. You know, I think that apparel can do that in some ways, but not the way that footwear can express who you are. And that's how I felt when I was a teenager and my footwear choices. And that's how I feel today. People put a lot of thought into what they put on their feet because it represents to me who they are.
I never understood that very well. But then in one of the gatherings I have with a lot of my college friends, one of the opening questions was, look at the person's next to you's footwear and give us an explanation of his or her personality. And I was so shocked. And I was looking at my shoe. It was completely just for 2 years. But it's so true. I think it does like show how much you care about like your appearance and also what kind of person you want or hope to be.
The web did a great job of bringing the physical catalog and turning that into a digital catalog. But it didn't evolve over the last 25 years much past that. I think if browsing experiences are still very difficult, scrolling, trying to figure out the holy grail of getting the right fit, because every shoe, every piece of apparel is made differently, is still a mystery. If you're building a digital business, your conversion rates are low and your customer acquisition costs are high. And whether you go from the physical retailers who are moving their selections online because they have to, or the digitally native retailers need a physical presence to connect with a customer. So, example, like it's Warby Parker opening physical stores, Allbirds opening physical stores. So the two worlds cross and intersect and need one another. So what I do know is that there is a whole new toolbox that is being developed to address specifically fashion retail in ways that we never had before and kind of Web 1.0. And I think that through AI and VR, cryptocurrency, NFTs, I think these are all super exciting areas that are going to revolutionize the way we think about fashion, the way we shop. And just speaking for this industry, it's, you know, I think we're at the dawn of a new age, a digital revolution. If you would ask me this question when I graduated from college, the internet didn't exist. And so if you asked me, what did the future of retail look like? My answer would not have included the internet. So I guess I answer your question the same way, that I don't know what it will look like and couldn't even begin to predict it, but it won't look anything like it looks today.
So to summarize, you think that these new ideas like AR, cryptocurrency will have a huge part in shaping what will be the future, but the future is still very much uncertain.
Yeah, I think people are going to, and they're already doing it, figure out ways to use these new tools to satisfy and delight customers. You know, I think pre-pandemic, only 15% of all commerce was done online. Obviously, the pandemic changed those numbers, and I think it's up over 30% now and drove a web adoption. But the web isn't a great experiential place, especially for fashion. You know, it's a great place to buy dog food. But if you want to see and touch and feel the product, I think it still has a long way to go. But I'm super hopeful that a lot of these new technologies are going to open up ways that we haven't imagined before.
what would be your advice for students that are our age going through the pandemic, finding and seeking their future career? What would be your advice to them?
I'd say, first off, I think the greatest trait that you can carry to be successful in the future is adaptability. The world is changing so fast. So many old industries being disrupted and new ones created. And like I said, when I graduated from college, the industry that I ultimately made my career didn't exist. And I think for people graduating from college today, they're interviewed in 20 or 30 years, they'll largely say the same thing. So you need to be adaptable. You need to be curious that learning doesn't stop in school. Learning is a lifelong journey and you have to seek it. It's not going to come to you. It's an exciting time. I think, like I said, with everything that's happening in technology right now, we're headed into a place of opportunity and abundance. And I think that all of these tools will open up people's ability and creativity in ways that have never happened before. So I think there couldn't be a more exciting time right now to be starting on your life after college, your life's journey.
What is your strategy in continuing to be up to date and learn stuff?
I read a lot. I try to surround myself or be connected with diverse sets of people where I can get diverse viewpoints and ideas and perspectives. It's one of the reasons that I like to be involved in so many different industries, whether they're, you know, old world manufacturing or new world digital marketing. I think it's about being open, seeking different viewpoints and perspectives, and ideas can come from anywhere. We had a saying at Zappos, actually Tony believed that every employee had an internal superpower, so that every employee had something to contribute. And what they needed was an environment to be allowed to contribute that. And boy, that was spot on. If you create the right environment for people, then they really do astounding things.
What was your superpower?
Was my superpower?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I think my superpower is realizing my areas of opportunity and surrounding myself with people that make me stronger. So I'm always been fortunate to work with great people and have great chemistry. And when you can find that magical combination, I think you can accomplish anything.
And what do you think Tony Hsieh's superpower was?
Tony Hsieh's, he had so many of them, but I think Tony's largest superpower was just his belief in people. Tony always said that he didn't want to be the tallest plant in the greenhouse. He wanted to create a greenhouse where all plants could thrive. And that's how he put it best. Tony wanted to just create environments where people could be their best selves.
Thank you so much, Fred.
Thanks, Christopher. I really appreciate it.